On February the 16th, we will present for the record are Representatives Gruenberg, Guerra, Coghill, Dahlstrom, myself, McGuire. And we will be taking up today three different things. We're going to start with House Bill 97, Oaths, Notary, Public, and State Seal. Then we'll go to a brief overview by the Department of Health and Social Services Division of Juvenile Justice. Patty Ware is the director. And then we have House Bill 88, Offenses by Minors Against Teachers, by the governor. And that's a bill we had heard last week and set aside. So, without further ado, House Bill 97, if you just go ahead and state your...
Black.
Yes, that's right. They look like it.
Good afternoon. I'm Scott Clark, Lieutenant Governor Lehman's notary administrator.
My name is Brian Westad, intern with Lieutenant Governor Lehman's office. Today before you, we have House Bill 97, which addresses changes in the Alaska notary statutes, which have not been updated since 1961. The changes being proposed today have been suggested by Alaska notaries working together with Lieutenant Governor Lehman's office. These proposed changes are outlined in the notary statute comparison handout, which you all should have, and I shall walk you through that. They're arranged in the categories of qualifications, terms, fees, bonds, commission types, commission revocation, and notary data. Going to the notary statute comparison, we have first qualifications. The current laws say that the applicants must be at least 19 years of age. And the proposed changes are that that age be lowered to 18. We have several reasons for this. One is that you have banks across Alaska which have requested that the age limit be dropped. That way their bank tellers can become notaries, which are usually hired around 18 years of age. At the same time, the new proposed laws will make it so that the notaries must reside legally in the United States and cannot be convicted, incarcerated felons within 10 years of application. For terms, the terms are relatively the same. Notary publics will continue to serve a term of 4 years, and we are also creating a limited government notary public, which relates to their position as government workers, and is that their term will end when their jobs end. Current fees. Currently, a $40 application for non-state employee notaries will remain the same, and we will be changing the fees for the certificates from $2 to $5, making a $3 increase. And we have samples of those certificates if you would like to see them. The bonds will remain the same, which is $1,000. Commission types, once again, notary public will serve 4-year commissions, and the limited government notaries will be available for as long as that person is a government worker. For commission revocation, we have currently the Administrative Procedure Act is responsible for that area. The proposed will be the Lieutenant Governor for cause via formal disciplinary procedure using administrative hearing office. This will make this procedure easier to deal with. Notary data, finally, is right now we have the notary's name, their mailing address, and surety information being collected. We propose that the Lieutenant Governor, for his own records, to get contact with these notaries, will be requesting other additional information to make it easier to get in contact with them. That concludes the statute comparison.
Great. Anything further you want to add? Questions from the committee? Representative Guerra.
That was a good presentation. I appreciate it. There were some things I didn't know about the notary law. Can I ask, my understanding is that it's not only rare, but maybe it's never happened that somebody who's been a notary then comes in and reapplies after is it 4 years that you have to renew? Has anybody ever not been renewed? I'm just wondering why we make them do it every 4 years.
Well, the law requires, sorry, through the chair, Representative Guerra, the law requires, is the limit is 4 years right now, which requires a renewal, and I'm not aware of any, you know, the requirements right now are very minimal. They have to be at least 19 years old and a permanent full-time resident of the state, so there aren't many people that don't qualify, and if they submit the bond and the fee, then that's pretty much all that is required. So no, there's not very many people, if any, that have ever been turned away.
Through the chair, Representative McGuire, Representative Guerra, we did, in the beginning, we vetted this pretty carefully with notaries on a listserv that we have. We vetted it with also industry groups, banks and credit unions and insurance companies. And we looked at, for instance, expanding that, saying, okay, you're paying $40, let's make it a six-year term. And because right now, apparently, in the banking industry, you're only getting about 2 years out. You're paying for four, but you're only getting two. The employees will turn over and go somewhere else. And so changing the term didn't seem an issue for any of the folks that we talked with. And again, we vetted it among the notaries themselves and their agencies, and no one suggested shortening it, lengthening it, doing away with it. So that's why we've kept it at 4 years.
Representative?
Thanks, Madam Chair. It would just seem to me, not taking into account the bank's interests, but taking into account the state's interest, our interest in reducing paperwork, that it seems with the number of notaries out there, we would save a fair amount of paperwork to not make people renew as often. And I'm hoping you'd at least consider doing that just for our sake. As a state, we don't want to make people engage in unnecessary paperwork and devote man hours to. If there were a lot of notaries not being renewed, that would be one thing, but I don't think that happens. And you still have the safeguard of taking away somebody's notary if they do something terrible.
The Chair, Representative Garrett, we will, if this bill passes, have the safeguard of being able to take away their ability to renew. And your point is well taken, and we will continue to consider that, because this is the first time since 1961. You know, there are many legislators that have introduced this bill, and it has not passed for whatever reason. And so what we'd like to do is make these changes. We're moving to a more web-based system, which we hope eventually may do what you're suggesting and not making people. I'm very, and I know Lieutenant Governor is sensitive to what you're saying about looking at it from the state's position. We are. But we also were trying to not be controversial, since it hasn't happened in 40 years or however long, since 61, to get through the things that are uncontroversial and then continue to look at ways to better serve.
And just on that same point, and for the record, it's Annette Kreitzer, on that same point, the fees themselves, are they passed through in the budget? Do they come back to you in terms of supporting the cost of administering the program, if you will?
Representative McGuire, no, they do not. There is no dedication of those funds back to the Lieutenant Governor's office for the purpose of operating the notary program. It is just simply a reflection of the higher cost of doing business since 1961. It's eating more out of our budget every year to do this, the mailing cost. Scott has done the research to justify the increase. We certainly didn't suggest an increase for the sake of an increase. That was asked in another committee. And so while we're on that point, I'll just address that. Because if there was no need to increase it, then we wouldn't have done that. There's no sense in raising costs to consumers. But Scott has copies of what we're talking about, and not every notarial act will require a certificate like this. So it isn't that every time you go to a notary, you're going to be paying $3 more.
Let me be clear. I probably wasn't on the licensure fees themselves. The $40 fee that hasn't gone up is my understanding. Oftentimes, obviously, we can't constitutionally dedicate funds, but what you'll see is a fee that ends up coming back to support, you know, the creation of that program and the licensure itself. And my question is, okay. Representative Groomberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We are looking into something. Apparently, the members, the version that you have that passed out of State Affairs is the F, as in Foxtrot, version. Harry Bannister apparently prepared a G version that we don't have. And what I'd like to do is to pass out something here that is a memo, if Madam Clerk, Counsel, whoever, that states all of the technical changes.
This is in the bill packets.
Okay. If you would look, the Terry Bannister memo on January 28th, explaining in paragraph 1 the changes that were made in the missing G version. This is under the category of lost. And what I'd like to do, Madam Chair, if I may, at this time, I had sworn to Ms. Kreitzer and Scott and Brian and the world, and I'm going to go back on my word, that I was only going to offer this one amendment. But I thought we were up to date with the Bannister G version. What I'd like to do is offer an en banc. We'll take paragraph 2 seconds. But I'd like to take section 1. If the members would just glance, those are all very technical changes. I'd like to offer paragraph 1 as an en banc amendment number 1.
Okay. So everybody understands amendment number 1. Madam Secretary, you have the memo?
I do.
Okay. And obviously we'll make that conceptual so that the drafter can change it to the F version and any other changes needed to comport with the new draft. Is there any objection to amendment number 1?
Madam Chair, I would just request, if we could ask Ms. Kreitzer.
Ms. Kreitzer, do you have an objection? It's largely technical. It's semicolons replacing commas. Parentheses have been removed and created under added. The definition of notary public and the accompanying cross-reference sections have been rewritten to be more precise.
Right. Madam Chairman, I apologize. I think I have seen this before because Representative Grunberg was good enough to share with us his language, and I'm just reflecting in my mind. I don't have that marked up copy in front of me, but we have no objection.
So any objection to amendment number 1? Okay, hearing none, amendment number 1 carries. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If the members would turn to page 11, line 3 of the F version. Excuse me, just if I may have a moment. I'm looking on the wrong thing. Well, although it says A at the top. Wait a second, excuse me. I'm looking. I'm sorry. Section 10 of the bill. Whatever that is.
Yeah, the duties. It is on page 11.
Page 11, okay. Page 11, line... Jesus, it's stuck together. Page 11, line 9. As stated by Ms. Bannister in her paragraph 2, that it probably ought to be a may rather than a shall. Thank you. I would, at this time, offer that as amendment.
Okay, and I'll object to hear what the Lieutenant Governor's office has to say on that.
Madam Chairman, we have no objection.
Okay. Any further objection to amendment number 2, replacing the word shall to may, page 11, line number 9? Is there any objection? Okay, hearing none, amendment number 2 carries. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would ask that the amendment, the only printed amendment that you have, is labeled F as in Foxtrot 1.
All the members have that. Okay. So amendment number 3 is the printed version, F1. Okay.
Madam Chair, if I may, that was essentially...
You want to move your amendment, Representative Grunberg?
I'll move it.
Okay, and I'll object just to hear your description.
That was crafted by the division, the Lieutenant Governor's office, to allow them to promulgate regulations allowing electronic notarizations when these become available, so they don't have to come back for another bill. And we talked about it in House State Affairs. I thought it was a good idea. And this was worked on by Ms. Bannister with them. and I would offer amendment number 3.
Any objection, Ms. Kreitzer?
No objection.
Okay. Any further objection to amendment number 3, which would simply allow for electronic means as the Lieutenant Governor's office gets more money, resources in the future, and perhaps goes in that direction? I think it's an innovative idea. Any further objection? Okay, hearing none, amendment number 3 carries. Any further amendments to House Bill number 97 from the committee? Representative Guerra?
Question, so I can decide whether to do an oral amendment. To apply to become a notary, to get a renewal, you don't have to do it in person, do you? You can do it by mail, or do you have to do it in person?
Chair, Representative Guerra, it can be done by mail. The essential aspect of this is a notarized signature, and an oath on the notary bond is required to be notarized, so it can be done by mail.
Other questions, sir?
Representative Grunberg?
I don't know if I need to technically put a disclosure on the record, but I am a notary public. I don't think that that causes me a conflict, but it should be noted.
So noted. Okay. I didn't have anybody else to testify, but just to be sure, is there anybody that has a burning desire to testify on House Bill 97? Okay. Anybody on the telephone lines that I missed? Okay, hearing none, public testimony is closed. Any further amendments? Hearing none, I'd appreciate a motion.
So moved.
With individual recommendations as amended and attached fiscal notes. Any objection to that motion?
Second.
Okay, hearing none, House Bill number 97 passes out of this committee. Thank you very much. Okay, so next we have the Division of Juvenile Justice. We asked you to come. You recall when we were hearing House Bill number 88, there were a number of questions that were brought up in the committee regarding statistics about the Division of Juvenile Justice, and as we were contemplating some of the auto waiver provisions in House Bill 88, and so I appreciate you coming, Ms. Ware.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Patty Ware, and I'm the Director of the Division of Juvenile Justice within the Department of Health and Social Services. I am planning on going for about 30 minutes with a little bit of time after that for questions, so if you need me to speed it up or move on, just give me a sign. I want to start by letting the committee members know what our agency mission is. The Division of Juvenile Justice's mission is to hold juvenile offenders accountable for their behavior. I do want to emphasize that accountability doesn't necessarily mean a locked institutional bed. In terms of our agency mission, accountability is accomplished in a variety of ways, including supervision in the community in a variety of capacities under the court-ordered probation supervision requirements as part of our process, and I'll go into a little bit more detail shortly. Another facet of our mission is to promote safety and restoration of victims and communities. Again, we are both a justice agency as well as a rehabilitative agency. Our efforts and emphasis is on letting juvenile offenders know that they have, in fact, harmed a victim, harmed communities, and that they need to pay that victim back and repair the harm that they have caused. And a third facet of our agency mission is to assist offenders and their families in developing skills to prevent crime. This is a really critical component of what we do because it's our belief, and frankly the research bears this out, that our responsibility is to make sure that young people leave us with a higher level of skill than they had when they came to us so that they don't reoffend, whether it's in our system or in the adult correctional system. I thought it would be helpful for the committee to talk a little bit about the juvenile system and some of the statutory framework and guidelines that guide our operations, because they, in fact, are different from the adult correctional system. And I know that when you had the other justice agencies come and do their overviews to you at the earlier part of the session, you heard from each of them that we are, in fact, a system. Juvenile justice is part of that overall justice system. Although we are located in the Department of Health and Social Services, we also work very closely with law enforcement, whether that's the state troopers or local police. We work very closely with the Department of Law. Our representatives in terms of attorneys are the district attorneys that are in the criminal division of the Department of Law in Susan Park's office. We obviously work with the Public Defender Agency as well as the court system, so I did want to emphasize that we are also an important part of that system. The delinquency statutes are in Title 47. Chapter 12 guides all of our operations in terms of how we handle police reports when they come to us, how we file petitions, secure detention, et cetera. And again, I'll go over that in a little bit more detail. And then Chapter 14 is where you will find information regarding juvenile institutions. In terms of regulations, in the Administrative Code, 7AAC52 has a great level of detail about all of the different facets guiding our facility operations, whether that's in short-term secure detention or long-term treatment, everything from grievance procedures to how we treat kids, the number of hours of exercise per day, et cetera. And then in Chapter 54, those are the regulations that guide juvenile confidentiality in terms of records both within the agency as well as court records. Our jurisdiction is for minors under the age of 18. I know that often in this committee, a lot of what you hear about are bills and pieces of legislation that have to do with the adult criminal system. There are differences between the adult system and the juvenile system. We are not subject to adult sentencing guidelines in AS 1255, except under certain limited circumstances. And we did talk briefly about that last week in the context of the bill that you heard. But just to reemphasize, there are automatic waiver provisions located in Title 47. So if you are a 16 or 17-year-old and you commit a serious either unclassified felony or a Class A felony against a person, then you would automatically be waived into the adult system. We in juvenile justice would not get that referral. We would not have the option of basically working with you in our system. That would go directly to the district attorney's office. They would handle that the same way they would an adult offender. Under certain circumstances, also as an automatic waiver, if you commit a Class B felony against a person with a deadly weapon and you have previously been adjudicated of a similar type of crime, then you would also fall under that automatic waiver provision. And again, that's located in 4712030. The other component of our system that has some elements of adult and juvenile, and in some places down south it's known as dual sentencing, it's in the same blended jurisdiction. We call it dual sentencing. Basically, again, there are certain requirements for you to qualify for dual sentencing. If you're age 16 or older, you commit a felony against a person and you have a prior adjudication, meaning you've been found guilty already of another crime, or you've committed sexual abuse of a minor in the second degree. Basically, what happens is there's a decision to subject you to both a juvenile court order and adult sentencing guidelines. If, in fact, you follow through on the requirements of the court under the juvenile order, then those adult sentencing requirements would not kick in. However, we would be able to invoke the adult sentence if you commit a felony or a misdemeanor against the person, or you fail to follow the conditions as set forth by the court. So those are some of the limited circumstances under which juveniles would be treated in the same manner as adults. But those are those limited circumstances. And so what I want to do now is kind of shift over and talk specifically about how we work with juveniles differently inside the juvenile justice system within the Department of Health and Social Services. Briefly, and I'm assuming everybody got the packet, so you should have, I'm following through on the slides that you have in your handout. In terms of detention in the juvenile justice system, the purposes are pretty clearly delineated in statute.
Representative Guerra.
I'm sorry, so I don't have to go back okay. Later. You were talking about the crimes that we already waive people out of juvenile court automatically for. And one class was Class B felonies done with a deadly weapon if you have a prior conviction. And then there was an earlier
of the same type of crime.
Of the same type.
Yes.
And then there was a more serious level of what you call very serious physical injury crimes.
Unclassified, what are those? Unclassified felonies or Class A felonies against a person.
Sexual assault, murder.
Correct. Yeah. You're welcome. Okay. Detention of minors in terms of statutory guidelines should be used to protect the minor or the community, again, public safety issue, or to assure the minor's attendance at a court hearing. So if we think the young person is a flight risk and is not going to show up in court, then that is the statutorily allowed purpose to use detention, and clearly, obviously, to protect the community. I should share with the committee that we have focused significant effort in the last few years within the Division of Juvenile Justice to ensure that the locked detention resources in our agency are in fact being used for those purposes. Because historically, there have been some uses of detention that essentially have less to do with risk to the community or concern about a minor's appearance in court and more to do with lack of community-based alternatives. And so we can't have this young person sitting around in a law enforcement officer's patrol vehicle, and so the kid ends up in a locked detention bed, not because he poses a risk to the community, but because we don't have anything else. We've worked really hard in the last few years to enhance some of the alternative community-based resources, so we're not using costly, deep-end, secure institutional resources when they're not warranted. What you see in front of you is also a reference to Detention Assessment Instrument, otherwise known as the DAI. This is a risk-based screening instrument based on objective information about this young person's history that DJJ implemented in November of 2003. The purpose of this instrument is to assist our juvenile probation officers in making those critical public safety decisions about who to detain when the young person is picked up by law enforcement and brought to the front door for those serious offenses. I also want to point out that although there had been some concerns on the part of law enforcement when we implemented the DAI that maybe we were compromising public safety, they weren't going to be able to get a young person into a locked detention bed, that has not, in fact, been borne out by experience. We've worked closely with local law enforcement. The instrument does have a what's called an override feature, such that if there are extenuating circumstances, even though the young person doesn't meet the scoring criteria to automatically get access to a detention bed, there's a lot of room for that professional judgment and exchange between law enforcement and juvenile probation staff. I also want to point out that when a young person is put into a detention bed, by statute, we either have to release him or her or bring him to court within 48 hours to get a judge's approval to extend that period of detention beyond the initial 48-hour time frame. And the folks who handle that are primarily the juvenile probation officers within the Division of Juvenile Justice in conjunction with the District Attorney's Office. Moving on to your next slide, I wanted to give the committee some sense of what type of options we have before us in the juvenile system with regard to judgments and orders. And again, these are for formal cases. We do a fair amount of work at the front end of our system, and I'll speak to that in a minute. But if we are talking about filing a delinquency petition and pursuing a formal court approach to a young person who's committed a serious offense, then basically the judge needs to find that young person delinquent. We get an adjudication, a finding of guilty, in essence. And then the options that are given to us at that point are what's called a B1, which is full departmental custody within the Department of Health and Social Services, and placement in one of our locked institutions across the state. And I'll speak to the committee in a minute about where those are located and what kinds of services we provide. Those are reserved for the most serious and or repeat juvenile offenders. Second option is what we call supervisory custody. The department still has custody of this young person, but they are released either to their parent or legal guardian. It's not deemed something that is a serious enough risk to community safety that they need to be in a locked setting. Third is full departmental custody, but placement in a non-detention setting. For most of our population, what that ends up looking like is what we call residential care. The Department of Health and Social Services has a variety of grants or contracts across the state with virtually all nonprofit providers who provide residential care, frankly, for both the abused and neglected population through the Office of Children's Services as well as the delinquent population. So those services are via grant dollar for youth under the age of 18. And the other option for our young people if they are not able to go home but do not warrant a locked bed is foster care. Juvenile justice tends to use foster care significantly less so than the Office of Children's Services, primarily both because of age and because of difficulty finding foster parents who want to work with a delinquent population. And then the far less frequent, but I did want to mention it, other option is a restitution order only, where we would not have the young person on, he would not have a probation officer in terms of formal court-ordered conditions checking in, and or electronic monitoring or other range of services, but it may be a situation where restitution is really the primary thing that we need to follow up on, so that's what we go into court to get. There are other options in statutes, but they're very seldom used, and so I didn't mention them here. The next two slides that you have just give you a sense of what our what comes in the front door, basically. The trip switch for juvenile justice is a police report from law enforcement. Again, that can either be from the state troopers or from a local police officer. And that's what kicks in the work that we do. In fiscal year 2004, DJJ received 6,189 delinquency referrals from across the state. Those 6,000 plus referrals represent 10,213 charges, because oftentimes police reports have multiple charges contained in a single police report. And that equates to 4,275 unduplicated kids that came to us as an agency in terms of our needing to work with and make a decision about. I would also say that the consistency is pretty, the percentage that you see in terms of crimes against person versus property, et cetera, that percentage is fairly consistent across a period of years. And so as you can see, nearly 50% of the referrals that come in the door are crimes against property, and then crimes against person, 19%, and then you can see the rest of the breakdown. I would also point out that although I didn't break this down by location, roughly 35 to 40% of the referrals are in the Anchorage area in terms of workload. The next piece of data that you'll see gives you an indication of the breakdown of those same set of referrals in terms of felony versus misdemeanor. And again, this is also pretty consistent from year to year. So 55% of the workload was for misdemeanor charges and 31% for felonies. And then you can see that there's conduct and probation violations as well. The next few slides, and I could, I will say that I could go on and on about the various work that is done by our staff out in the field. I can't say enough about what both a very difficult job that they have, as well as, frankly, what a good job they do working with some very difficult juvenile offenders to really try and get them both to pay back to the community, but also, again, looking at that ultimate outcome, trying to reduce the likelihood that they reoffend. And what I would say is that the bulk of Alaskans, when they think about juvenile justice, what they think about is the resources that we provide in the way of locked, secure institutions. And that makes sense because those are large and they're concrete and they have big perimeter fences, and that's what people tend to think about when they think about accountability or, you know, juvenile justice. But what I'm here to tell you today is that that is, although a very large part of our budget, because it's very expensive to manage 24/7 institutions, every single one of those delinquency referrals is handled by a juvenile probation officer. The bulk of the work that comes in and the kids that never make it to a locked institutional bed are handled by juvenile probation staff in the community, in your communities, where they're supervising kids at home, they're supervising kids at school, they're making contacts in a work setting, they're partnering with law enforcement in a school-based setting. There is a tremendous amount of accountability, making sure that young people are paying back restitution, making sure that they're performing community work service, and that they're doing the things that they need to do so that they can get off the conditions of formal court-ordered probation, move on to do something more productive with their life. And I really want to emphasize that that is a really important part of the work that juvenile justice does. And so as you can see, when that police report comes in, it's their job to take a look at that, make sure that there is legal sufficiency, that we can actually pursue something, make a decision based on the young person's history, the seriousness of the crime. If a young person has been brought to that front door of detention, which doesn't happen with every offense, clearly, if it's not a very serious offense, it may take some weeks, in some cases months, before we get the police report. So not every juvenile is brought to the front door of a juvenile detention facility by law enforcement with a request to detain. When that does happen, though, the person who does the detention screening and make that decision in terms of public safety is the juvenile probation officer. They are also the staff who are doing the bulk of the work in terms of initiating formal court action. And although I didn't put that in the data, we in general, in terms of our workload, we file delinquency petitions, meaning pursue formal court processes, on about 35% of the cases that come into our door. And that, again, has been pretty consistent, between 30 and 35% for the last several years. Another important role of juvenile probation officers is victim contact throughout the entire justice process. We are required by statute to make sure that we are informing victims of the juvenile process, getting a victim impact statement from victims, making sure that they understand what their rights are, that they can appear in court and testify, making sure that if a young person has been institutionalized by the court and a victim has requested notification, that we notify them when that young person is going to be released. Another thing that I would also say is that based on workload and other duties, I have to say that we have, while we've done our best with respect to victims, it has been very difficult to manage that juggling act, and that has been usually the piece that has fallen down by the wayside. So I will say that there is a request in the governor's budget for fiscal year 06 for four victim services positions within the probation services component. The other piece I wanted to share with the committee, because it's been a significant system initiative on the part of the division in the past year, is that we are implementing something known as the Youth Level of Service Case Management Inventory, otherwise known as the YLS for short. It's really important for us to be making appropriate decisions about which young people pose a risk to the community, and we absolutely should be pursuing formal court action, which young people need to be institutionalized, which young people that no matter whether we touch them, talk to them, do anything with them, their level of risk is so low that we really should not be spending state resources and working with that young person. We have spent a while looking at the research, looking at instruments that will allow us to do a better job. This is the one we've landed on. We're excited about it. It's objective, factually based. And essentially what happens is you do a thorough couple-hour process with this young person and or his or her parent, and then you get a sense of, is this a low, medium, high, or very high-risk case? And so in addition to substituting our existing process, which is frankly woefully outdated and not very well researched, we are taking that process, which we at the moment don't do until we've already made a decision to file a delinquency petition, brought that young person to court, and already adjudicated him or her, then we do the risk need assessment. We're pushing that up much further in the process so that we are using the information to help us make the decisions in the first place, thereby helping us to use our resources better and also making sure that we have much more thorough information by which to plan a young person's case and make sure that we're targeting our efforts more appropriately. So I'm pretty excited about that process as well. Flipping over to the next chunk of what we as an agency do, and as I said, I think this is the most visible portion of the work that juvenile justice does. DJJ has 8 locked facilities in the state of Alaska. Those are located in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, Bethel, Matsu, Ketchikan, Kenai, and Nome. The state has a total of 288 secure beds, and those are of two types. Short-term detention beds are usually for a period of up to 30 days. Again, this is pre-adjudication where we are making the determination about what to do with that young person in conjunction with the district attorney's office. We have 4 standalone detention centers that only do that short-term detention, and those are the smaller facilities in Matsu, Ketchikan, Kenai, and Nome. And then in terms of long-term treatment, when we've gone through the court process, the young person's been adjudicated, we've gotten a B1 institutional order, the 4 largest facilities that have long-term treatment are those in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, and Bethel. And they have both detention and long-term treatment in their facilities. Our institutions, and this is also relatively new in the last few years in terms of a really concerted effort, are focusing some of our resources on transitional services and reentry, so that when a young person, after he or she's been in an institution for 2 years, 3 years, or more, depending on the level of crime and how old they were when they got institutionalized, it's our responsibility to make sure that we're working with him or her and the family and hooking them into community-based resources so it's less likely that they reoffend and come back to us. Anchorage has the most comprehensive model. It's called the Transitional Services Unit, and we are trying to use that model and adapt that to some of our smaller standalone facilities so that we can transition young people closer to their home communities. And then the last thing I wanted to say about our institutions, again, a very significant system change for us as a division that I could spend hours talking about in and of itself, is something called performance-based standards. This is a national quality assurance initiative developed by the Council of Juvenile Correctional Administrators in conjunction with the U.S. Department of Justice, Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention. Alaska has signed on to that recently within this last year, and essentially what it does for us is it focuses us on outcomes for both our detention units and our treatment units, and it's a very rigorous, exacting process. Basically, the categories of the outcomes are safety, security, order, programming, health, mental health, justice, and reintegration. It's, again, based on best practice and research such that we have the desired outcome, we have expected processes and standards, and then suggestions as to how we're going to get there. What the process requires is two data collection cycles per year. Alaska just completed our first one in the month of October, whereby every facility had to enter in data into a web-based portal on all 159 outcomes for treatment and 59 outcomes for detention. What we get back is a significant amount of data for each one of Alaska's institutions that tells us how we did on those particular outcome measures, both compared to our own baseline and compared to the national field averages. And then we use that data to develop individualized facility improvement plans that then cycles back into what we do in the field and how we're improving our services on an ongoing basis. So this is going to be another primary push for us as an agency over the course of the next few years. And then the very last two slides that you have in front of you are, again, not all of our performance measures. We, like every other executive branch agency, have a number of performance measures that we report to the legislature. I didn't put all of them down. I put down the four that I thought you would perhaps be most interested in. The first slide talks about reoffense data. This is for the entire, we do that in two ways, as I mentioned to the committee last week. After a young person has completed his or her formal court-ordered probation period, we track him for up to 2 years, and what you can see based on the data for 2004, which would have been the cohort that was tracked since 2002, is that the reoffense rate was 22%, or for a 78% success rate.
Okay. Representative Coghill.
Just a question on the aging out, Patty. Is that something you can track here as well?
Through the chair, Representative Coghill. That not in this cohort. We do in the next piece of data. The problem with this is that there are so many kids, we don't have the resources to go into absent and do a hand check. I recognize that that's a problem. We're working with the Department of Public Safety to kind of figure out a way that we can track this large volume of kids into the adult system so we can get a better read. So I suspect that the number would potentially be higher, although the other thing I would share with the committee is that it's counted as a reoffense even if all we get on you is another referral. We don't wait until you're adjudicated. So it might end up actually balancing it out, because that's a pretty rigorous definition to count as a referral as a reoffense as opposed to waiting until we got an adjudication. And then the next piece of data that you have is for the more deep end kids who've actually been adjudicated and served a significant amount of time in an institution. When they're released from institutions, we track them also for 2 years, and Representative Coghill, this group, because it's a much smaller group, we do go in and hand check for every one of those kids. 1 year rate for the most recent set of released kids, which were those released in 2002, was a 37% reoffense rate after 1 year, and that goes up to 58% after 2 years. And what's counted as a reoffense is whether we got a new juvenile institutional order on you, whether you had an adult conviction, or whether we got another juvenile adjudication. So that's what that second set of numbers looks at. And then the last slide that you have is a way for us to share with you our success regarding those kids who are in the community paying back the harm that they've caused. In 2004, restitution collection, and this is for informal cases only, because formal restitution tracking is done by the Department of Law. But for informal cases, again, supervised by our probation staff, we had a 90% collection rate, and in FY04 collected $144,140 in restitution. And in 2004, juveniles performed 23,720 hours of community work service across the state, which is a 96% success rate compared to what was ordered either by the judge or by a probation officer. And I would be happy to answer questions.
Just one more question on the restitution collection.
Yes.
I mean, it's really good numbers, and so I appreciate that. But I guess when I look at it, I'll probably start thinking, is that as per the first court order? Is there adjustments in there? Because I know that sometimes if they go through some activities, then restitution is relieved. And
through the chair, Representative Coghill, this is at time of case closure. So once the case is closed, this is what it looks like.
Further questions, Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Chair. If you go back to page 5 on the reoffense data, you have that an average of 37% of those released from a facility reoffend, and 58% after 2 years. That's the way I said it is the way you intended it. That's what that statistic shows.
The chair, yes.
And you don't track after 2 years. It seems like a very high reoffense rate.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I would like to improve upon that. Again, part of the work that we've been doing pretty focused in the last few years is to really focus on objective information to help us in our decision making, and also making sure that the work that we're doing is based on research-based approaches. And so I agree that I would like that number to be better. I would also say, however, that in looking at some of the reoffense data from systems down south, we're actually not doing too poorly, which is unfortunate. And again, I think we do need to continue to try and get those numbers up.
Madam Chair.
Representative Kira.
I'm going to ask the same question over again, because the number is so high that I can't, that like there's a 1% chance in my mind I'm misunderstanding this. But this is, so within 2 years of being released from a juvenile facility, 58% of those who are released reoffend. I think that's, I know I'm asking the same question again, but I just want to make sure I've got it right.
Gary, you are absolutely correct. What I don't have in front of me today is what it looks like in terms of, so for example, and you know, what that means is that you could have had a young person who was released from a juvenile facility on a murder charge and committed a very minor offense. It's still an offense. I'm not saying that's acceptable. But I think part of what we also try to look at is kind of gradual approximations to appropriate societal behavior. We also track internally. I don't report this to the legislature, but we also track more serious, less serious, or the same level of seriousness in terms of our reoffense data.
Yeah. It is disturbing. What did you say, Patty, earlier about, you said there's a study underway to get more of this information, more accurate tracking of?
Madam Chair, for the probation cohort, which we are not currently tracking into the adult system, we're working to get, we're working with public safety, and we're trying to figure out a way that we can actually do that, given the hundreds and hundreds of kids we're talking about. I mean, when we only release a few kids a year, because that's the other point about the institutional cohort, it's a pretty small N we're talking about. We release, I want to say, again, I don't have that number in front of me, but Madam Chair, that's what I was talking about. For the probation cohort, we're working to try and make sure that we are tracking that population into the adult system, whereas right now we released 106 kids in fiscal year 2. That is the cohort that is tracked into 04.
Yeah, I think that's critical, because what you explained at the outset of the presentation is that the majority of the work is going on behind the scenes with the probation officers, mm-hmm. foster families, the support systems there. And so if we don't have that information, we're missing a huge part of the equation. So that would be very helpful. And
I would say to you that it will probably be some months, potentially after adjournment, before, because we're still working out the protocol. So I certainly hope that I will be able to have the capacity to report back to you next session. But we're going to have to figure out a way that we can swing that within.
And then just in wrap up, and I'll go into other members, you mentioned that you did have a system for those folks that were released of tracking whether the offense that they recommitted was serious or not. I mean, there was some level there. Do you have that information? Or
Madam Chair, we can get that back to the committee.
I think that would be helpful to understand, too. Representative Coghill and Goldstrom?
Kind of an interesting culture change you went through in how you're going to house people in your detention centers. So in looking at the offense rate and everything, I'm sure even that'll change, because the cohort will change, I would imagine. But what about those who now are going into community services? What is the feedback you're getting as you hear back from those who may be getting other services that maybe a probation officer would be tracking? Am I asking the wrong question? I'm just trying to figure out what happened to those other kids.
Through the chair, Representative Cockle, if I'm understanding your question correctly, what happened to those other kids who used to be potentially default in detention and are now
in the community services? That have they stepped up, or how are we doing?
We're working on it. We are not sufficiently. I cannot tell you that we have a full array of services everywhere we need them. We have expanded some non-secure shelters in certain parts of the state. We have added electronic monitoring services in some parts of the state. We're working on adding more of that. We are, and frankly, use pretty routinely community-based mental health services and substance abuse services as well, and that's a critical component in terms of making sure that kids in the community have the resources that they need so that they don't come back to us.
Representative Kira?
Tell me if you know what percentage of the kids in your jurisdiction have substance or alcohol abuse problems. I guess maybe I would also include, I guess, FAS problems in there too.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, the FASD piece would, we don't have data on that. We did do what we call a one-day count in 2001. We had hoped to repeat it every year, but we have not yet done so, where we pulled the records for every single kid in the juvenile justice system, both in the institutional setting as well as probation, and everybody who had a DSM-4 diagnosis, whether that was a mental health diagnosis or a substance abuse diagnosis. So we can get that in. We can tell you what percentage of the cohort had a substance abuse and a co-occurring substance abuse and mental health disorder. I can get that information to the committee.
And then I just want to ask you, in preparation for the next bill that's coming up, you know, there's already a section under the juvenile justice statutes that allows for a waiver of jurisdiction, not an auto waiver, but a waiver if you make the case that the minor is unamenable to treatment. And I want to know, in your opinion, whether you think that that is working. You've obviously been...
Madam Chair, I think that what you will hear... and I think what was brought up last week, I think it was from both law enforcement, if I'm not mistaken, as well as from the district attorney's office in Anchorage, it is very difficult in court to get a discretionary waiver. It's extremely difficult. And by that, I mean including on murder cases. The division, in conjunction with the district attorney's office, in the past few years has... filed for discretionary waiver and has not been granted by judges in different parts of the state. So again, it's not just a single jurisdictional issue. It's very difficult to get a court to agree to waive someone under the discretionary component of the delinquency statutes.
And then I guess kind of a broader question, is it your opinion in looking at these young people that have entered the delinquency status or system, I guess, that time in the juvenile justice system does them better, serves them better in terms of their ability to reacclimate or become a member of society again? Or is it your opinion that the young people that you have seen that have gone on to the adult system, my understanding is there's a separate section of that adult system that serves juveniles, but the adult system nonetheless does a better job at returning these people, these young people, back to society in a state that allows them to be members, upstanding members of society again? It's a broad question, but it's kind of the philosophical question that I think some members of this committee are trying to ask ourselves. And since you're the head of the juvenile justice system, I just kind of want to know what you think about that.
Make sure I understand your question. Clearly, I, as the head of the Juvenile Justice Agency, do in fact believe that we do a good job. I do in fact believe that our institutional services, and I think that's what you're talking about here specifically with this question, provide an array of treatment services for juvenile offenders. However, to some degree, that's a different question about whether I think that there are certain criminal offenses that are of a serious enough nature that the young person should be waived into the adult criminal system. And so they're somewhat two separate questions. I would defer to the Department of Corrections in terms of the services that they offer, but I think that the administration's position, certainly with regard to the next bill up that you have, is that this is a serious enough offense that it is appropriate to ask the committee to consider making that part of the mandatory waiver.
Statute. And along those same lines, one of the things we didn't get into very much detail on is what services are you offering young people? We talked about the role of probation officers and foster families, and but it was sort of vague. I mean, are there alcohol and drug treatment programs?
Madam Chair, in the institutions, is that the question? In the institutions, first of all, as I think Representative Guerra mentioned last week, every young person is required to go to school just like they would be if they were on the outside. So they have a chunk of their day that is involved in education and meeting the requirements of local educational districts so that they can graduate or move on to whatever stage they're going to in terms of their education. We do provide substance abuse prevention and or treatment services depending upon the particular facility, because again, we've got some different resource issues depending on where you're located. We have contract mental health services in our treatment institutions, and most recently have just added a mental health clinician also in the Anchorage facility, the Bethel facility, soon to be in the Juneau facility, and we already have one in Fairbanks. A range of treatment groups. Anchorage has some specialized units that nobody else in the state has. They have a sex offender unit that offers specialized sex offender treatment for juvenile sex offenders, so no matter where you are in the state, if you're adjudicated on a juvenile sex offense, then you are sent to Anchorage to get your treatment there. Anchorage is also the only institution in our system that has a separate girls unit. So if you're an adjudicated female offender, then you would serve that time in Anchorage and get gender-specific treatment services that no other institution offers in our system. Anchorage also has what's called a closed treatment unit for some of the more serious, either violent offenders or mental health offenders, and essentially spend a lot of time doing specialized programming under the guidance of mental health clinician and or psychiatrist or psychologist, depending on the needs of that young person. In all of our facilities, we provide a range of anger management, victim empathy classes, a whole array of treatment services. Again, we're moving more towards some additional evidence-based practices that I hope to implement sometime in the next year or two, depending on resources.
Any questions?
Thanks. Thanks, through the chair. This is where I'm going to be more blunt, because I'm just more blunt than the chair is. Let's just talk about the class of crimes that this bill addresses. So the bill that we're going to hear next, let's just talk about people who've committed those crimes. In your opinion, would we have a better chance of preventing a kid from becoming a reoffender by sending them through the juvenile justice system or by sending them through the adult justice system? And we're just talking about this group of kids. Does it make any difference in your mind, in your opinion, or do you think we'd do a better job of reforming them so they don't reoffend by sending them through the juvenile justice system?
I think the administration's position on the bill that you are about to hear is that it is an appropriate waiver to add appropriate offense and a serious enough offense because it involves weapons, that it should be added to the mandatory waiver.
I don't think you're going to get a different answer. So, any further questions? Okay, thank you for your time. Okay, with that, House Bill 88, back up. Annie Carpinetti and Bob Linton is on the line to answer questions. Al Story is here to answer questions. Steve Branchflower is available to answer questions. Annie, we'll just have you come up so we have someone here. Okay, is there anybody else online from the public that wishes to testify on House Bill 88? Anybody here from the public in the audience that wishes to testify on this bill that has not? Okay, so beyond Ms. Carpinetti, we'll go ahead and close public testimony. So the bill is before us. Committee discussion or questions from Ms. Carpinetti? Thoughts, amendments? Representative Dahlstrom.
Madam Chair, for a point of clarification from me, did we adopt the amendment that was passed out by Representative Gruenberg?
No.
I asked if we adopted your amendment. And through your chair, Representative Gruenberg, are you planning on passing that amendment?
Yes.
Lisa, do you have copies of that amendment?
Oh, here.
Got my two folders combined.
This is the A1 amendment.
This would just make House Bill 88 conform a little better with what we were doing in 41. Representative Kira.
Question, actually, before we get to the amendment. Ms. Carpinetti, we just got a letter from the Department of Law, and it summarizes four cases where a juvenile engaged in a crime that was essentially murder or the was an accomplice to a murder. And so the memo talks about, in these discretionary waiver cases, the judge didn't grant discretionary waiver in three of the four cases. My understanding was that murder cases are cases that are automatically waived. So I don't understand. I'm probably missing something, but how is it that if murder is a case that's automatically waived, these ended up becoming discretionary waiver cases? What am I missing?
Through the chair, these are 15-year-olds, or younger than 16. The automatic waiver goes for only 16 and 17-year-olds.
So in the murder cases, it's an automatic waiver at 16, but these were 15-year-olds.
15-year-olds.
And the bill that we're considering now, we're just talking about 16 to 18-year-olds,
16
right?
And 17-year-olds.
17-year-olds. I understand. Thank you.
Okay. All right. We have got amendment number one before us. Representative Gruenberg, you want to move your amendment?
I'll move it.
Is there any objection to amendment number one? Okay, there's an objection. You want to speak to your objection, Representative Coghill? Or?
Just
I'm not a big fan of the school grounds issue. I understand the argument. I just can't get there. So, I'm kind of trying to dust off my brain a little bit here. I understand why we'd want to have it maybe in a bus. Here's I guess my basic problem. We are going to ratchet up now based on a place rather than on an action. And I know that's been even pared back from that a little bit. Like I say, I'm trying to dust off my brain and go back and remember how we argued this a little bit. But I stumbled over that the place issue. So
yeah,
I'm just at this point, I'm not ready to vote for it. That's why I objected.
I understand. Yeah, this was the debate that we had. Just getting our minds back to the Representative Lynn bill, which essentially, rather than making it an aggravator, it was a mandatory minimum sentence under a certain class of folks that exist in statute right now, police officers and first responders and so on. And in that debate, this similar amendment was offered or discussed, and the debate centered around whether or not you would talk about specific school employees or whether you would just say on the grounds themselves. And some of the concerns that were brought up were, what if you're walking your dog on the school grounds, or something like this, would you then fall into this category? So that's a bit of a refresher.
Thank you.
Representative Coghill?
And I know that we already have some laws about misconduct of firearms around schools anyway. So, I suppose that's appropriate. But here we're talking about a waiver of misconduct involving the firearms. I think it's like so many other things you do. The more you describe it, the more opportunities you have for problems. And I think I'd rather stay close to the conduct rather than the place.
Madam Chair?
Yeah, and this is, just to be clear too, this is the assault is the underlying offense. So this is kind of a separate section of the bill that refers to assault. So it really could be that push, bump, this type of a thing. And then where the other part of the bill is referring to the gun violations. But I knew what you meant.
I was off a little bit.
I knew what you meant. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is, of course, an aggravator. And any person can commit any crime against the person to come under this aggravator. And the way it is now, the aggravator only applies if you direct the assaultive conduct, or it could be coercion or anything, against a school employee. I don't know if the members have a copy of AS 11.61.190 and .195. That's the misconduct involving weapons that is referenced in Section 4 of the bill. But if the members do, let me just read you the relevant section. Subsection 1161.195A, misconduct involving weapons in the second degree. A person commits the crime of misconduct involving weapons in the second degree if the person knowingly violates AS 1161.200A1 and is within the grounds of or on a parking lot immediately adjacent to them. They have various schools, etc., like that. So and I don't know if this is what Representative Coghill was referring to, but the crime itself, this particular crime, is made, in this case, a Class B felony if it is located on the grounds or in a parking lot immediately adjacent to the school. And that's what I've attempted to do here. And what I'm trying to do is to protect anybody who is there, because the people who are most at risk, really, there are far more children than a few teachers, and it could be other people there. If you're concerned about walking a dog or something incidental, people don't generally walk their dogs on school ground, at least while the school's in session. I'd be happy and consider it a friendly amendment if we were to say on school grounds while school's in session, something like that. I mean, that's my intent here. It's not my intent for somebody who's out there on a Sunday afternoon walking the pooch to have an aggravated factor. My wife's not here on dog parks, that's why I can say that. But we're talking about while the school's in session. Lightning, forgive me.
Representative Dahlstrom. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Gruenberg, would you consider it a friendly amendment to say certain crimes committed against school employees and then insert you're on school grounds on a school bus? That might take care of some of the concerns that some have, that it's just open-ended for anyone there. I mean, I think we're still getting to the root of where we want to go. Would you consider that a friendly amendment?
I would. It wasn't exactly the intent of the amendment to begin with, but it certainly makes it more precise. And I would certainly support that through the chair, Representative Dahlstrom, if I may dialogue. I'm going to really say once just the reason I offered it. I would consider it a friendly amendment, but I would ask, is there any interest at all in anybody on this committee except for myself in getting this aggravator to be allowed to be used if anybody is assaulted during a school event on school property or in a school bus, something like that. So that they could I'm talking about protecting anybody who's there.
I'm not sensing a tremendous amount of support. I think, speak up if you'd like, but I think Representative Dahlstrom's proposing an alternative that would incorporate a lot of your hard work and ideas in a way that would probably be more supported by the committee, but every member of this committee is free to offer amendments as they wish, and so it's your decision, Representative. So it would kind of go back to what we arrived at in House Bill 41, which would add so it's still a school employee, but it is on the school grounds, it's a school bus, a school-sponsored event, the administrative offices, which is something you brought up that I don't think any of us had really thought about.
I would be happy to support that, Madam Chair.
Okay.
I don't know if you need to say while the school's in session or something, but, I mean, because you could be going, visiting this principal there when school's
Representative Dahlstrom, your friendly amendment would be to leave in against a school employee, but then to expand it to on school grounds, on a school bus, at a school-sponsored event, or in administrative offices of a school district.
That's correct. School.
Okay, does everybody understand the friendly amendment that has been accepted by Representative Gruenberg? Okay. Representative Gruenberg. Representative Cox?
Madam Chair, my only concern with that is,
you're right.
You know, I think we're all on the same page in who we're trying to protect, and we want to ensure that the kids have a healthy environment to learn, but where would we then cover, say, those student teachers who are there as a consequence of completing their MAT degree? Should they be swept into this?
Vanessa.
I'm there and my final semester requires me to do internship as a teacher. I'm not really a school employee, I don't believe, unless we define that to such extent. I mean, they should be afforded the same degree of protection because, again, we're there to ensure that the kids are in a healthy environment to learn. And if that person's in fear of some reprisal or some activities that could jeopardize their own welfare and safety, then maybe they ought to be included into this concept.
And Madam Chair.
Vanessa is going to get that language. We ended up amending 41 to say, against a school employee, I think it's or their designee or someone contracted with the school district. So she's going to get that language while we're thinking. Representative Guerra?
I think you could probably cover all of that by doing a school employee, volunteer, or intern, and I think that's everybody.
Well, but that doesn't get at the school bus drivers that are on contract, because they're not volunteers or
contractors.
Yeah.
School employee, intern, volunteer, or contractor. Seems.
Madam Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
I would support that concept.
Okay.
I would just ask logically. Are we still not going to protect the children?
Tough argument. Representative Coghill?
First of all, based on testimony that we've had before, we have protected the children. So what we're doing is we're stiffening it up. So I think based on previous testimony, the need for many of these aggravators at this point has not been on high demand. So I think we have been protecting them. So. But I think what we do, the more we describe these, and I think just bringing up this student-teacher thing shows that we might inadvertently be causing some inequities when we start trying to say the place is more important than the offense. And so I just struggle with that, that's all.
Representative Grunberg?
Sure. I would ask Ms. Carpinetti. Is there an aggravating factor if you assault a child on the school ground or something?
The chair, not to my knowledge, which is, it might help that the reason that some people have focused on the place, and that's not what is in the original bill, is that the most important focus is having a safe place for kids to learn. There are also other reasons why you would focus on the person. The problem when you start defining the person, you think, well, what about the man who fills up the Coke machines? He's not a contractor, he's with the school. You don't want to see that kind of violence on the school grounds either. So that's the justification for the place. But I understand that, once you start going through the type of people, and we have done that in the context on the other side, including volunteer, intern, various other people in authority who might be victims. But
your bill, or your boss's bill, does not discuss the place so much as it does the person.
The person, correct. And the on the other side, the place, the rationale for the
place.
I think
one of the concerns we brought up, frankly, while we're on the subject of juvenile delinquents, is the concern that you have about an altercation between students that now becomes a very serious aggravator.
May I respond to that? I mean, certainly that is not my intent in offering this amendment. These are discretionary with the court. The court may aggravate. It's not required to aggravate. The judge is not required to. And I think we can make it very clear in the legislative history or have some legislative intent, whatever you wish. That's not my intent. I'm talking about innocent children in a Columbine kind of situation or something like that. I've got to say, and I'm just letting folks know, I feel very strongly that we must protect the children. And if a parent was there or whoever, I'm not talking about the parent who gets it in an altercation or something. I'm talking about an innocent person who's there, If you're in church, you deserve protection. I think if in school, you deserve protection.
Okay. Representative Crocker?
Madam Chair, I totally agree. However, as we go down this road, we've already got school grounds and school-sponsored event and school employee in the original bill here. As if I understand correctly, we're already at the place where there has been a conviction. So if we're going to have other aggravators with regard to schools, I don't know that that your language makes that much difference. I mean, we've named a place, we've named a person here, and we start down this list. What we're going to do, I think, is we're going to create more problems than we solve.
May I respond?
Briefly, and then Representative Kira?
I'll yield.
Representative Kira.
I'm having a lot of trouble with this bill, and that's why I'm having trouble with the amendment. Let's just make clear for a second. We're not talking about whether we're sending these kids to jail. They're going to jail. We're not disputing whether or not somebody who engages in a serious crime should be punished. They are going to be punished. All we're talking about is whether they go to jail with other children or whether they go to jail with adults.
But this is an aggravator for adults. This isn't aimed at children. This is for adults who commit assaults on school crime, on school grounds.
It's actually true. The section, it's tough to keep her.
Six of you are way ahead of me on this one.
Yeah. So. What's happened, Representative Coghill went down that path too. It's hard because there are two separate sections. So section 3 really does just talk about an offense under chapter 1141, which is only offenses for adults. So we really are just talking about adults on adults. So the case I just described, without doing an auto waiver for fourth degree assault on a school ground for a 16 or 17 year old, which will maybe be your next bill, without that, this is really just adults on adults. So the question really that we're faced with is whether we want to change course. Remember, House Bill 41 that left here, we made the decision to leave it against a school employee or an individual who has been authorized by the school district to provide pupil services. And then we clarified that it had to be on school grounds, a school bus or school-sponsored event, or in the administrative offices, and that was because we didn't want a school employee that was sort of in the grocery parking lot to have some different type of treatment than somebody else who was assaulted in a grocery store parking lot. So we wanted to be clear that it was the type of employee and the place that they were that was sacred. Representative Gruenberg's point really, I think, is, do you want to say that anybody that's in that area, that's on the school grounds, that's on the school bus or the school-sponsored event, whether they're an intern, contract employee, teacher, or student that is assaulted by another adult, will have this aggravator available to them?
I'm sure. I'm not just being a theoretic here. As a lot of you remember, about 8 or 10 years ago, a nut came onto Mountain View School wielding a knife and slashing children in my district. I'm trying to protect the children in your districts and my district. I have grave difficulty at protecting only adults and not the little ones. That's not fair.
Representative Coghill?
No disagreement with the aggravated intent there, but this law does nothing to protect children. All it does is say that if you do this kind of stuff, it gets worse. So if we're going to protect children, you know, we've got to put somebody in a building that's going to protect them. So
I totally agree. I'll accept that as a friendly.
And looking at the aggravator, and I'm sorry, I started down the wrong road, as my good friend over here did. So at this point, I'll remove my objection. I think we've had the discussion. I don't think it's complete, but I just don't know what to do about it.
Madam Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
I got to say, I've offered a number of amendments. If you only accept one of my amendments these 2 years, accept this one to protect the children.
That argument. Okay, so Representative Dahlstrom offered a friendly amendment, and we were kind of discussing. At one point, we thought you'd take it. I don't think you'll take it anymore. So I'm not sure.
To have a vote on this amendment.
Okay.
I would hope we can withdraw our amendments and protect the children.
Okay, so Representative Dahlstrom, will you withdraw your friendly amendment at this moment, and we'll have a straight up or down vote on amendment number 1. And by the way,
is there an objection?
I'll object just for purposes of briefly hearing from
Ms. Carpinetti, this is the governor's bill. Do you have a position on this amendment?
Our position would be this is fine. The amendment would be fine. It's similar to what has been done on the other side. It makes sense in a lot of ways.
I have a question for Ms. Carpinetti.
Representative Guerra.
Ms. Carpinetti, do any of the aggravating factors right now increase the sentence? Or is there an aggravator for a crime where the victim is a minor at this point?
I think there are. Through the chair, there are aggravators for victims who are extremely vulnerable, and that would include a child. So there are some aggravators that apply to young people.
But the I just want to make
fairly to.
So if the victim is a 16-year-old, is an extremely vulnerable person, and that aggravator, that's not a 16-year-old probably, right?
I wouldn't think so, depending on the circumstances.
So this isn't redundant to another aggravator that we already have?
Through the chair, I don't believe so.
Okay. Thank you.
We've decided over here that if you'll agree this is your only amendment that we'll have to take this session. This, on the record, that this will be one we'll take. So I withdraw my objection. Is there further objection to amendment number one?
Madam Chair, I was prepared to support the amendment, but hearing the witness testify that the other side has done something very similar leads me to be a little more wary of their motivations, but I think it's a good amendment. I'll withdraw any objection that I might have had.
I thank you.
We note your philosophical concerns on the record, Representative Cockhill, but I think you just don't like the whole concept in general, probably. Okay, so my amendment is withdrawn. Any further objection? Objection to amendment number one. And so, amendment number one by Representative Gruenberg has carried. That brings us to amendment number two by Representative Garrett. Now, this does speak to the heart of the bill, which is putting into the auto waiver provisions of our statutes. This is the thing that says they will automatically, 16 and 17 years old, be waived into the adult system as opposed to having a hearing and making that decision about whether or not they're amenable to treatment before the age of 20. And so, amendment number two by Representative Guerra. You want to move your amendment, Representative Guerra?
Next, I move amendment number two.
And I'll object just to hear you talk about it. It looks like it's the property part that's...
Yep. This has to do with the part of the bill I thought I was talking about before, so oops. The bill aims to transfer a whole class of kids into adult court automatically. Kids who engage in weapons crimes, kids who engage in very serious activity. One of the crimes that wants to waive kids into adult court and adult jail for is the crime of discharging a firearm from a propelled vehicle that damages property. It's shooting at a road sign. It could be worse. It could be shooting at a house, but that's covered somewhere else. Let me go back for a second. There are other sections of the law that say if you shoot at a dwelling, if you shoot at a building, if you shoot at a place where there's an unjustifiable risk that you might hurt a person, that's a crime also, and that's fine. But what this amendment does is it says if you were shooting at uninhabited property, in essence, and you just caused property damage, that's not something you should be automatically waived into adult court for. So it still allows the governor to still waive kids into adult court if they engage in a weapons crime that involves substantial risk to a person. But it just backs out this. If the only thing is substantial risk to property, it's saying that's not an automatically waivable offense. So.
Okay. Ms. Carpinetti, before we go to a committee discussion, as a courtesy, since it's your bill, I'd like to hear your opinion of the amendment.
Well, I generally agree that property crimes are different from crimes against a person. Under these circumstances of first degree misconduct involving weapons, it's really hard to imagine somebody shooting a gun out of a moving vehicle that they wouldn't be endangering another person. But to the extent that there might be those unusual circumstances, that it could only be like shooting at the sign or something and nobody was around, I suppose I don't have an objection to that. I would like to ask Bob Linton, who is online, for his opinion, because he's really much more familiar with these cases than I am.
Mr. Linton, are you there?
Yes, I am, Madam Chair.
I don't know whether he has
and
a copy.
And I don't know if you have a copy of the amendment, but you've heard Representative Guerra's description. If you want any further, we can fax it to you, but it'll probably take a minute. What are your wishes? Are you prepared to respond?
I didn't know what the amendment was. The operative language I'm aware of is that it would automatically waive misconduct involving weapons in the first degree and second degree in their entirety. Certain subsections that are taken out, is that what the amendment is, Madam Chair?
That's correct. Do you want to go through it again real quickly?
Mr. Linton, all I'm doing is we're going into 1161-190A2. Right now, the bill sends all of these kids into adult jail. I'm saying the part where you want to send them into adult jail for engaging in the unjustifiable risk of physical injury to a person, I'll let that go. But the part where you want to waive kids into adult jail automatically for engaging in unjustifiable risk of damage to property, I'm not really willing to give you that one. So I think that's the point.
Through the chair, this is a statute that's on the books now. So what we're saying is if there is an adult who shoots at a street sign, is driving down the Glen Highway way south of town, hit halfway to Portage Glacier, past Gird Wood, so that there's little danger that a bullet hit anything other than the street sign, we could prosecute an adult for that now if the construction on the statute that the representative is giving it is a reasonable one. And I guess I see the situation is if it's unreasonable for us to apply the statute that way as to adults, it's unreasonable for us to apply the statute that way as to juveniles. So it seems to me that this is that in some senses this decision has already been made, that is that this language is appropriately applied in situations where adults commit these offenses. That being the case, it seems to me that it behooves prosecutors to look at the language and see what constitutes a substantial and unjustifiable risk of physical injury to a person or damage to property. And I don't know of any instances where adults have been charged under this statute for shooting at road signs in remote areas. And I guess I see this as the kind of thing where that's been the law on the books. It has not been misapplied so that the language substantial and unjustifiable has been applied to a road sign in a remote area. So I guess I don't see the risk of people, prosecutors or courts or police applying this to the remote road sign as a really significant danger.
Mr. Linton, obviously all that aside, you know, obviously one legislature doesn't bind another, and it's our job to constantly reflect on these policy decisions that have been made. You wouldn't believe some of the things we've uncovered in our statutes that frankly are in print. So all those arguments aside, what would be more compelling to me personally would be to hear an example where you could find a case where somebody is presenting an unjustifiable risk of physical injury to property that wouldn't involve an unjustifiable risk of injury to or physical injury to a person. Because I think what Representative Guerra's amendment is trying to do is focus on that injury to a person. It may well be that you're shooting at a stop sign in which a group of construction workers are nearby working on a water main or something like that, or certainly at a dwelling, which is frankly in the second degree, but it could be something like a lamppost in front of a home where people were obviously inside.
could you give me, I mean, I guess what I want to hear is not just that somebody else already put it in there, and so if it's good enough for the goose, it's good for the gander. I'd like to hear why you think that the risk to property, unjustifiable risk to property, deserves this escalated treatment.
The two instances, I think it was two instances, Madam Chair, that I testified about last time involved shooting into automobiles parked outside houses. Were there people getting into or getting out of those vehicles at the time? Would people normally be getting into or getting out of or likely to be in vehicles? People just sitting inside, outside their vehicle to avoid the fight with the wife or the husband? Those were two instances where it was not only a house, it was an automobile that got shot up.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Representative Guerra and then Gruenberg.
I really don't want to get this thing confused. I'm not trying to change the law as to shooting at, if you look at 1161.95, which is already covered by this bill. If you shoot at a dwelling, the governor wants to waive that kid into adult court, and I'm saying that's okay. So when you shoot at a dwelling, that's already covered. So that's one of the examples you just mentioned. If you're shooting into an automobile and you cause an unjustifiable risk of injury to a person, then you also get waived into adult court. So I'm not trying to back that out of the bill. I wouldn't mind hearing an instance where you're not causing any danger to a human being where you want that you think justifies us sending a kid into adult jail. That's the question we're dealing with in the amendment. Do you have an example of a situation where somebody damages property, where they pose no unjustifiable risk of injury to a person, and you think that person should go to adult jail when they're 16 years old? That's the question.
That is the question.
Well, I had prepared by looking for examples, and I found examples in general, and not specific. I had to find ones where a juvenile fired into an empty house or an empty automobile. Because the actor is so indifferent to it in the first place. The shooter doesn't care. The shooter wants to terrorize. And it may be people in the house. It may be the person standing outside the house. But the people inside the house or the people inside the car, the innocent people, are the ones who are endangered by it.
Madam Chair.
Representative Gruenberg?
You know, I was the guy who brought up the idea of the street sign when we were driving down to Seward over Perry, and every little sign had bullet holes in it. But on the other hand, and when Bob Linton's talking, you know, something came by. We were a victim of this, actually, on our little house on Kenai Avenue. Somebody drove by and put a hole in our van. That was damage to property. I think we were at home asleep at the time, but the van was parked out in front. Somebody shot it. It basically was what amounted to a drive-by shooting. And in that case, definitely that was a serious, and I would say this, whoever's van it was, you know. On the other hand, the statute itself, the underlying statute, is broad enough to include somebody shooting at a roadside sign where there's nobody within 10 miles.
I have an idea, Mr. Linton. Look for me at 1161.195, 3A and B. They talk about discharging a firearm at or in the direction of, and so it's a building with reckless disregard for a risk of physical injury to a person or a dwelling. What about adding automobile as C? So under the second degree, you're getting at the situations you seem to describe and excluding the sort of broader, you know, property is a very broad definition. It does include street signs, frankly.
May I ask a question, Madam Chair?
I want to hear his response. Do you have a response, Mr. Linton? Or Ms. Carpinetti?
I did want to say that Mr. Linton probably doesn't have many examples of the situation that you pose, because that is the type of case that probably would not be prosecuted under this section, and because this is a serious Class A felony, and we use our discretion when you're shooting at the sign, and in charging, and of course judges and juries use their discretion too when they think we haven't made the appropriate charge. So I guess in the big picture, I would not have a problem with your particular amendment. I don't think Mr. Linton would have a problem with your particular amendment. The different in terms of only a street sign out in the middle of nowhere where there's no house around or no car around where people might be present. I could be wrong. I hope I'm not misstating your comments. In terms of adding vehicle as an automatic, I would want to think about that because you know, you could also have a vehicle out in the middle of nowhere where there's no chance of a human being inside. So I guess if you gave me the choice, I would prefer this amendment to that approach.
Great. Okay, so further discussion on amendment number 2 by Representative Guerra. Representative Coghill, did you want to say anything?
Nope.
Any further discussion? Okay, I remove my objection. Is there any further objection to amendment number 2? Okay, hearing none, amendment number 2 carries. Are there further amendments to House Bill number 88? It passed. Any further amendments? Okay, hearing none, motion.
Madam Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
Just I guess I would just add, if I may through the chair, talk to Ms. Carpinetti here. The situation, the problem arises, and I don't know how, and maybe you just want to think about this in the Department of Law, the use of just the broad term property as opposed to various kinds of property. You could be having somebody shooting at a bill, you know, a car in front of your house, where it's fairly serious. I withdraw that. You can't cover everything in the world.
Representative Anderson.
Yes, Madam Chair. I move CS for House Bill 88 as amended with
in front of your house.
Individual recommendation.
There's an objection. Representative Guerra, speaking to your objection.
I don't know if I'm going to even ask for a vote on this bill in this committee, but I just feel compelled to share my concerns about this bill. This is one of those bills that has come to us without any sort of evidence that the current law isn't working and this would make it work better. We don't have a single instance of anybody who's engaged in one of the crimes that's covered by this bill who hasn't been waived into adult court or who's been improperly non-waived into adult court. We just don't have any cases like that of 16 to 18 year olds who the prosecution believes should have been waived into adult court that weren't. But we have the bill. I mean, the bill makes, you know, if I wanted votes, I'd vote for the bill because I think I can get some votes out of this. I think I could knock on a door and tell somebody I was really tough on crime. And the conduct involved in this bill is bad conduct. But A, I haven't heard of any cases where the current law is causing an injustice. B, we didn't hear any evidence from anybody with any expertise come to this committee and say, say we could do better in reforming kids and keeping them from reoffending by waiving them into adult court. The law right now says if you have a better chance of preventing a reoffense by putting them in juvenile court, you do that. Nobody's been able to come to us and say that this is almost a double negative, so let me figure out how to say it. What I would want to hear is that kids who can commit this kind of offense, the kind of offense in this bill, can't be reformed any better in juvenile court than they can in adult court. Therefore, since they can't be reformed any better in juvenile court, we're just going to send them to adult court. That would make me support this bill, I think. But we don't have any evidence like that. Nobody's presented a shred of evidence like that. No expert, no person with a background in the field has come to us and given us that evidence. So we're really, in the end, I think, voting for a bill that nobody's come to us and shown a need for. It sounds great. I'll get vilified at a few doors for voting against this bill. I haven't heard the basis for the bill, other than these are bad crimes for which kids are already being sent to jail already anyway.
I think, and one thing just to add to that, we did receive, and I just wanted Mr. Linton to know, we did receive your letter dated February 16th that does describe one case, at least, that goes to the point. This was the 16-year-old from Kenai who engaged in a verbal argument with the driver of a truck, and as the truck drove away, this 16-year-old pulled out a .357, fired three shots at the driver. The shot struck the back of the cab of the truck. One bullet lodged behind the driver's seat but did not penetrate any further. Two other bullets passed through the rear window of the truck. One of those bullets lodged in the passenger door frame, almost striking the passenger. No one was hurt during the incident. A petition to waive juvenile jurisdiction was filed in Kenai Superior Court, and Judge Halbrand declined to waive juvenile jurisdiction. So there are four cases outlined, and one of them seems particularly important. But I do share Representative Aguirre's, the second part of his concerns, and I would encourage, Annie, you're very smart, and you followed this stuff for a long time, and I know there is a lot of discretion, and I understand that the waiver statute appears not to be working, at least from the testimony from Ms. Ware and you. But it would be nice to know, last I checked anyway, one of the goals of our penal system is still rehabilitation. It's hard to find that anywhere anymore, but it is still there. And particularly when it comes to young people, because these are not crimes that you're going away for your whole life for. We don't have the death penalty in Alaska, so we're not killing them, and we're not sending them to prison for life. So they will come back into our society again. It's an absolute fact. And I think that's what's so scary when we deal with 16- and 17-year-old criminals. It's scary for everyone, and what you do with them is obviously all of our concern, and certainly protecting society and future victims and forcing them to pay for their crime is also a huge part of it. But that being said, it would be nice to know that there is some effort that is going toward rehabilitating them, knowing full well that we're going to see them again. And so that's on the record you might think of in preparation for your next committee if you end up having any thoughts on that, or maybe even Ms. Parker would be available to talk about some of the work that goes on. Representative Groomberg.
Yeah, now, despite what I said a few minutes ago, I can't resist. We have a tradition here that we normally, and I'm looking at some technical things, Madam Chair, here on the bill. I'm going to support the bill. I think it's a good bill. And the guts of the bill are in sections 3 and 4, and I'm not going to talk about them at all, and in section 5. Some of this other stuff I'd like to look at, because we try to simplify things here. And we normally don't have, for example, short titles in bills. We have struck them in the past. And we normally, unless it's essential, don't have legislative findings. And I don't see a need for an effective date on July when we normally have a 90-day effective date. And Madam Chair, I'd like to respectfully recommend that we delete those sections. They're not essential to the bill. We're trying to keep this simple. We want to don't have a larger target here for any objections than necessary. We keep the full guts of the bill. And I'm just wondering through the chair whether...
So your motion is technically out of order. The motion on the table is to pass this bill out of committee as amended. You know, where is the bill going to finance? With all due respect, Representative Groomberg, since it's 3:05 and Representative Anderson and Cott have to go on to the next committee, those are good points. We've had the bill a couple times. These folks have been waiting in the wings. It's not that we're hurrying the bill out. I would ask if you would consider withdrawing your amendment and offering it either on the floor, if it goes that far, or in the next committee. and let's just stick with the motion at hand, and I think we'll have a vote on that. Thank you. Representative Guerra.
I'm going to withdraw my objection and let this bill out. I mean, I'll think about it more. It's not necessarily, it's not that I oppose the bill. I mean, I might oppose the bill. It's that I don't understand the need for it. I do have one more question. I can speak to Ms. Carpinetti. There's that one example that you went through that seems to be on point, but I've got questions about it. I don't think it is, and I'll talk to her after the committee.
Yeah. Appreciate your comments on the record. The motion, the objection's been withdrawn. Is there any further objection to House Bill 88 moving out as amended? Okay, hearing none, House Bill 88 as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes has moved out of this committee and on to House Finance. With that, we're adjourned.